The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
Welcome to part two of episode 143 of The Partially Examined Life. We were talking about Plato's dialogue, The Sophist. And last time, talked about the stranger. It's not Socrates, it's the stranger. His attempt to figure out what the sophist is by various means of dividing concepts into yet smaller concepts and more specific things. And he finds a lot of different definitions, all kind of pick out some qualities of the sophist. And so finally, he gets on this one about imitation. And that's kind of where we stopped, that the sophist fills us with lies, fills his subjects with imitations of truth. And so this gets us to the big digression, which is, hey, the sophist is going to say, oh, but haven't you read Parmenides? Parmenides says there's no such thing. Everything's being. How could there be falsity? Because everything is one. Everything is being. And so there's no such thing as not being. And so falsity, what could that possibly be? Falsity implies not being, but you can't even talk about not being. So how can you say that I lie? That doesn't make any sense. You're just talking nonsense. Somebody want to give a better version of the Parmenidean view?
Well, let's give an example of a falsehood and why that's a problem. Theaetetus is flying, which is false. What's objectionable about that under this theory? The stranger puts it, but he who asserts says that falsehood exists, this is 237, has the audacity to assert the being of not being, for this is implied in the possibility of falsehood. So one very conventional way to think about this, which is not the way it's talked about in the dialogue, is that if I imagine Theaetetus flying, I have the idea in my mind, but it's not there in reality.
Truth is an affirmation of being. Is that analytically true? If you say something is true, then you're attributing being to a state of affairs. If you say there is a duck here and there is in fact a duck here.
It's false that Theaetetus is flying. And then I take that Theaetetus is flying as some sort of entity that has being. Is that the...
Part of the problem with this is that in the end, we do talk about the being of non-being, right? And so in the end, it's not going to be a problem. In fact, it's going to be a solution.
In fact, the way you just described it, Wes, it sounds like Russell's...
No, it is. This is definitely related to definite descriptions. And that was more a question of meaning. Like, if you say the present king of France is bald and there is no present king of France, then that statement is just meaningless, or is it false? And that was a huge puzzle until Russell analyzed that, you know, as an existential statement. There exists an X such that X is the king of France and X is bald, and therefore you can say the statement is false and not meaningless and avoid all those problems. I think the paradox here is that you say there is a falsehood. When you say something is false, you're saying that something that is not is. It is false. I don't know if that's right or a good way to put it, but...
Yeah, you're hitting the nub on the contradiction from Parmenides. If you claim something is false, that it's true, then you've run into a contradiction, and therefore it's a paradox. And it reminds me a lot of the kind of paradox you have in ancient Greece, of like Zeno's paradox, right? If I'm going to go from here to there, from where I'm sitting to the wall on the other side of the room, I have to go halfway there. And I have to go halfway again. I have to go halfway again. But if I keep breaking it in half, I'll never get there. Yet somehow I do get there. So in a way, that's the paradox, right? And when I think about that particular paradox, I think, well, what you've just revealed is that you're just not thinking about it correctly. Maybe your solution is you're going to have to invent calculus in order to come up with a way to talk about it. But you are finding out that dividing distances in half, as you ultimately find out, dividing it in terms of ratios of integers doesn't cover the whole distance. It doesn't work. But you know by empirical fact that you can cover that whole distance. And so there's something not quite right about your way of numbering distance. I mean, that's ultimately in the case of Zeno's paradox. That's the way I think of it. And so in here, I think you somehow get a little bit of, you're not thinking about this correctly, even here in this dialogue, where you end up asserting the being of non-being in a very particular context by revealing the other. I'm getting ahead of ourselves. But
I just want to reiterate this example before we get into those abstractions, yes. Which is that, so to say that it's not the case that Theaetetus is flying means to assert the non-being of Theaetetus flying, which is to assert the being of non-being. That's the paradox.
And I just want to orient us for people that don't remember who Parmenides is, don't feel like we're just name dropping and excluding you, that Parmenides, along with Heraclitus, are kind of the biggest of the pre-Socratic philosophers. And remember this Eleatic stranger, he's Eleatic because he's from...
Elea,
that Parmenides is from, and he's supposedly a student of Parmenides, as was Zeno, who did Zeno's Paradox. So we still owe the people a Parmenides / Parmenideans episode that I promised them after Heraclitus and promised them after Hegel, talking about being, and it will come eventually, but we're giving hints of it. We're getting an advanced peek.
Anyway, Parmenides is famous for saying all is one, and he's sort of a partisan of being, let's say.
Was he a New Agey guy? All is one. Was he a Hindu?
Yeah. It sounds very Plotinus. Very in line with kind of a mystical...
Plotinus, known as the Neoplatonist. So yeah. As Plato is usually taken, we were saying earlier that certainly with the way that Plotinus and Augustine reads Plato as, you know, the guy who says, really, it's the forms. And it's only a slight jump to that to say, really, it's the form of the good. That's the only really real thing. And everything else is just the skin of the onion, is just illusions. And so far in this dialogue, we've not seen that. All right. This is in 263, 264. Let's say more about what the problem is. You're asserting the being of non-being, and that sounds like a contradiction. So it takes him a long time to solve this contradiction, but Plato is actually going to do that, that he's going to have the stranger commit patricide, metaphorically kill his parent Parmenides by arguing against this Parmenidean doctrine that everything is ultimately one, that there's only really being, that non-being is not only just an illusion, the way Augustine would put it, but it's something that you can't even sensibly talk about because you'd be doing exactly what you were just describing, Wes. You were saying that being, if you say it is not there, it is absent, you're using an it, but an it implies a being. So saying anything at all about non-being is making an entity out of something that is not an entity.
I'm using this word non-being. Doesn't that have a referent? Isn't it like me saying that here's an object and it has the property, there being no such thing, right? But the way language works, it looks like if I'm using a word, I have to be referring to something. And so if I'm referring to it in order to negate it, negating it while at the same time asserting its existence by referring to it.
You're asserting the existence of the negated thing.
Yeah, just by mentioning it. So that's where the present king of France paradox sort of fits into. When I use a noun that has no, or a phrase, descriptive phrase that has no referent, how does that work?
Before 257, which Mark pulled us to, there's this short side discussion about rest and motion, which end up being categories like being and non-being that are fundamental, almost like, I don't want to call them forms, but...
ontological categories.
Yeah, ontological categories. And one of the confusions becomes that being seems to be both.
So in other words, we can say everything that is in rest or in motion, but we can't say that to be, that these things exhaust being, right? They can't, because if they did, then there'd be no third thing that was neither of them to predicate of them, right? So we'd have to say motion is at rest, or rest is at motion, or something like that. We need this third overarching entity being for them. So you can't really define being by the things that it's cut up into. It may be true that everything is at rest or in motion, but that doesn't exhaust being somehow.
So I guess for Parmenides, following Zeno's paradox thing that Dylan described, then motion is illusory, right? Motion seems like it's not simply being, that it's becoming, that it's change. But because motion is impossible, essentially the way that you described it, then that must just be an accident of the way we perceive things. We talk about this explicitly about Augustine, that if we could really take the God's eye view, then there would be no motion. It would just be being. So in that sense, motion doesn't really exist.
And just to be clear, that's not the stance here, right?
I'm trying to figure out what is Parmenides' view that he's arguing against. I thought then Heraclitus' view is, at least one way of putting it, is that for something to exist at all, it has to be in motion, or at least in tension. in opposition with something else. Like, that's what makes something stand out as an existent. Now, you could talk about the whole system where all the different tensions cancel out. And so there's something not entirely opposite about Heraclitus and Parmenides' view that you could say, okay, yeah, Heraclitus is just emphasizing the flux and the tension of the individual elements, but still could maybe have a Parmenidean view of the whole. But it still sounds like, well, what is being? For Parmenides, only ideas have being. For Heraclitus, at least the way he's often interpreted, is that only motion has being.
Yeah, and the part of Heraclitus, you'll remember, that seems most like it's at rest would be the logos itself, the ratio, the relation, the thing that stays the same. And so that's where you manage to escape complete and utter chaos, is you have things in proportion to one another. And those proportions don't change. And so in some sense, those proportions are at rest. And that's the way you might go in that Parmenidean way.
So it doesn't seem like Plato shows any real understanding or cognizance of how interesting those kind of views are here. That the stranger talking to Theaetetus is just saying stuff like, isn't it obvious that you can call two things, you know, there's hot and cold, say, well, that's two things. What possible reason could you have for saying there's ultimately no difference between them? Like, he just doesn't get it. 242, a moist and a dry, a hot and cold. The Eleatics in our part of the world, that is, you know, Parmenides, say that all things are many in name, but in nature one. This is their mythos, which goes back to Xenophanes and is even older. And he gives a lot of different variations off this.
He's sort of giving a kind of history of philosophy, right?
Yeah. So a few lines down, when these philosophers talk of one, two, or more elements, which are or have become or are becoming, or again, of heat mingling with cold, assuming in some other part of their work separations and mixtures, tell me, Theaetetus, do you understand what they mean by these expressions? When I was a younger man, I used to fancy that I understood quite well what was meant by the term not being, which is our present subject of dispute.
So, you know, the whole point of all this, remember, is to get us to this point where some things, they're a communion of some kinds, but not of others, right? That's around 252 where he draws that conclusion. So we just want to keep that goal in mind because it's going to lead to the solution of not being as kind of otherness as opposed to this entity nothingness.
So 243, he wants to interrogate the philosophers that say that, you know, ultimately these different principles are all one. Ye, who affirm that hot and cold or any two principles are the universe, what is this term which you apply to both of them? And what do you mean when you say that both and each of them are? How are we to understand the word are? Upon your view, are we to suppose that there's a third principle over and above the other two, three in all, and not two, hot, cold, and being? For clearly you cannot say that one of the two principles is being, and yet attribute being equally to both of them. For if you did, whichever of the two is identified with being will comprehend the other, and so they will be one and not two.
At this point, remember, he's sort of voicing what they would say, right? He's sort of speaking in another voice, right?
Right. He would answer that the two, hot and cold, will be resolved into one.
This is a way of saying being is not simply reducible to those things, right? It's one thing to say that everything that is either hot or cold or is in motion and rest. But if your theory is that being is reducible to those two things, then you have a huge problem on your hands. To say something is, you know, you'd have to be able to predicate rest of motion and vice versa.
I'm trying to get at, you know, it's over a couple pages here that really his ultimate response to these people is, I just don't understand what you're saying when you say that these will be resolved into one. You know, he asks, please explain this matter to us. Let us no longer fancy that we understand you when we entirely misunderstand you. And what will the assertions of the oneness of the all? Must we not endeavor to ascertain from them what they mean by being? So ask them, is there something that you call being, and is being the same as one? And do you apply two names to the same thing? What will be their answer?
So there's a section at 252 that sort of, I think you're right, Mark, that at some level he's taking them at face value and then having a pseudo discussion with them, a pseudo dialectic in which to show that what they're saying doesn't make any sense.
Right. And here's just two lines down from that. I think the essence of that, to admit of two names, right, hot and cold, and to affirm there is nothing but unity, isn't that surely ridiculous? So there you go.
Yeah.
You're saying that there are multiple principles, but yet it's all one. And that's ridiculous because there's multiple names involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And he goes through that with motion and rest. And 252, I think I'm just, you know, he's recapitulating. Having, you know, gotten this far, says, it seems all things have suddenly become upset at once. the claim of those who set the all in motion and of those who bring it to rest as one, and all those who say that beings are sorted by forms that are forever in just the same condition. For all those people attach the verb to be, some saying that all things are in their very being in motion, and others that all things in their very being are at rest. Exactly. And further, all those people who sometimes combine all things and sometimes divide them, and whether they divide and combine them into one and out of one, limitless elements or elements that keep to a limit, it's just the same whether they posit this as coming about by turns or continuously. They'd be saying nothing with all these claims if there's no intermixing at all. That last point is there has to be a way for these things to interweave with one another. In fact, that's the word that ends up getting used. There has to be a weaving together of these different things in order to be able to have things mixed up at all. You can't have pure beings.
So the whole point of this is to get at the transition to the explanation of not being is where we get to the point where what he's trying to reject with all these theories is the idea that everything communes with everything, or...
Yeah, this communes part was kind of confusing, so let's get into that. Why is this an issue?
So the whole conclusion of this, shall we refuse to attribute being to motion and rest or anything to anything and assume that they do not mingle and are incapable of participating in one another? Or shall we gather all into one class of things communicable with one another? Or are some things communicable and others not? Which of these alternatives, Theaetetus, will they prefer? So the whole point of all of this is to lead us to this third alternative. So there'll be certain kinds of categories or kinds, like otherness, which relate everything to everything.
So I think we need to use the word communicative in here because that's what was confusing in the previous part that you read. So one idea might be that, you know, if you say all is one, that means every predicate that you come up with applies to everything in your ontology, ultimately, because ultimately they dissolve into one thing. So if you're Schopenhauer or a Buddhist or whatever, then you see all these individual people and objects and there's ideas, but ultimately these are just appearances. So every predicate that is legitimately applied to anything should apply to anything else, according to Plato's. You know, if you really have that view that everything is ultimately all one, then all predicates apply to everything. And clearly that's not true, because then everything that is in motion would be at rest. Everything that is in rest would be in motion. Everything that is cold would be hot, et cetera, et cetera.
But it's also not as if everything is completely separate. They have to be able to commune with one another, right? Things intermix with one another.
So what's the thing that he's arguing against with that? Is that like a hardcore atomism of the old style Democritean variety, or some other sort of irreducible pluralism that there's a light force and a dark force or whatever, that just to try to explain how these things could coexist?
Yeah, you could use motion and rest, since that's the example he used.
Okay.
So
how do they commune with each other? Motion and rest. I mean, one, something stops. The same thing is in motion, and then it stops and it's at rest. There's one way of communing, but that's different than predicating motion of rest and rest of motion. That's,
well, I mean, isn't it the example, you're sitting there and you aren't moving, but internally you are moving, or you're growing, or you're wasting away, right?
Hmm.
You're in motion at the same time that you're in rest.
Or if they had the principle of relativity, even better.
No, I think that's that. So motion and rest can't partake of each other. That's an example of categories that do not participate in one another. But there are other categories that will commune with each other. And it'll turn out, for instance, that being and non-being will be an example of those categories. You can assert them of the same entities because non-being will turn out to be otherness. So there'll be no contradiction in saying that those two things commune in this weird word. Commune. There are some kinds which can be attributed to the same thing, and there are some that can't.
Well, and there's a section 251. How do we predicate many names of the same thing? What's written in the margin? It's amazing that that's an issue, but yet that's one of the problem statements here, that if you were a Parmenidean, you might have trouble with that. You know, if everything is ultimately one, on what basis would you apply different names of it? You'd have to have some sort of explanation, which of course, like Buddhists do, they have like, there's ultimately reality and then apparent reality, and all these supposed differences are part of apparent reality. Plato doesn't get into specifically how a modern version of Parmenides' view, well, it's not even that modern. Vedic, you know, all is one, is just as old as this dialogue, so I'm not sure why he's totally blind to that, but I guess that's not what the Parmenideans were actually arguing.
I'm not sure we're doing justice to this.
Well, so we've been struggling to articulate why this is a problem, right? Because in some ways, mm-hmm. on the surface of it, it doesn't seem like it should be a problem. It takes some work to understand why Zeno's paradox isn't just stupidity. Why would you actually be confused about that? And so the argument that the stranger is trying to argue against is presenting the paradox and the conundrum, which in some ways doesn't seem like such a conundrum at all. Like, at least to me, when I hear, well, things are mixtures of other things, it sounds like sort of obvious. Like, why would you have been so stumped about this?
So the way the rest in motion paradox ends is that you can't say that being is just motion rest, because then you have to have the contradiction of attributing one of the other when you say motion is. If being is motion and rest as a concept, and I say that there is such a thing as motion, then I'm saying motion is motion and rest. That's that contradiction. But then if I say that being is some third thing outside of motion and rest, then he says, well, how can you say that, you know, everything is at motion and everything is at rest? It's as if you're saying there's something that neither rests nor moves. Like, if you're thinking of reality as reducible in this sense, and you say, okay, so someone's trying to say reality, being just is nothing but motion and rest, and you've gotten past the first paradox where you say, okay, that doesn't work. And then you say, okay, I'll concede there's some third thing. Reality is being plus motion plus rest. Well, that implies that there are some things that neither rest nor move. So that solution doesn't work. So that's the way that whole paradox ends.
Wouldn't that also imply that if everything is rest and motion and being, that some of them are also not being? Wouldn't you also have that implication as well?
I don't know.
The way you just said it, everything is rest and motion and being. No, why does that imply that some of it is not being? You just said everything is being.
I mean, if I do it the ands and be all logical about it, then everything is also rest and everything is also motion.
I mean, I think the whole point of this, it's pointless to try and say what being is, to try and reduce it to these elements, because you have to use the is and the word to be even to talk about those elements. You're never going to get past that paradox.
Is that different than the paradox we had before with the paradox of instantiating non-being?
He's saying they're related. So
okay.
He's trying to say, look, yeah, this paradox of non-being, in a sense, applies to being as well. To talk about being is to talk about something totally indeterminate. If you try and give it any determinacy, you'd give yourself all these paradoxes. You have to leave it indeterminate.
Is that the direction they go here, recognizing the indeterminacy of being?
Well, they just leave it. So the way it leaves off is, then being is not the combination of rest and motion, but something different from them, Theaetetus, so it would appear. Being then, according to its own nature, is neither in motion nor at rest. That is very much the truth. Where do we look for help? I don't think we can look anywhere. And then they move on. So he says, when we were asked to what we were to assign the appellation of not being, we were in the greatest difficulty. Do you remember? To be sure. And are we not now in as great a difficulty about being? I should say so. Then let us acknowledge the difficulty. And as being and not being are involved in the same perplexity, there's hope that when one appears more or less distinctly, the other will equally appear. This is sort of setting us up, right, for the weaving notion. Yeah. And if we are able to see neither, then there may still be a chance of steering our way in between them without any great discredit. And then they get into the predication problem, which we probably don't need to go over that again.
Say what the predication problem refers to again. Just you can't say that something that's at rest is in motion and vice versa.
So the idea is that when you say, so there's, you know, the sophistic or the clever people who run around trying to, you know, mess people up with contradictions will say you can't give many things to the same. They're treating predication as if it were identity. So you can't say X is white and X is good and X is tall and all that stuff. Only good is good. Only man is man.
Right. So that's the interweaving thing that Dylan was talking about. You have to have the same object that can have multiple properties.
Yeah, we have to have a sense of is, which is not identity, which is really kind of what all that rest and motion paradox stuff is about. You're saying if you identify being with rest and motion, that's where you get the problem.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Wes. That if you use that coupling verb, it's not an equation. It's not an equal sign. This also makes a little bit of sense of why you would get into a discussion about same versus like as a result of this, which isn't going to be exactly the same discussion, but it's in that universe.
Yeah, so we're back to this idea that some classes are communicable with each other and some are not. So do we need to say more about what that means?
Well, so it just seems like this whole thing, you know, why this is historically important is that maybe he is, through this dialogue, establishing something like the modern way that we approach ontology. That people before him were just, what is there? There's the four elements, or everything is one, or there's just mind. But they didn't have within that picture, like, well, what is this is part? Is another element among the other things? Because especially if you are saying it's all one, then you're using the is in the equal sense. And so at the end of this, we're going to end up with, well, substances, not exactly Aristotle's metaphysics, is we're not going to get out of this, but we're going to end with, yes, okay, there are things that have properties and there are properties. And of course, the things that have properties, some of the properties they can both have at the same time. You can be both tall and fat, but you can't be both fat and thin because the different properties apply in different ways. And all of this has being, and the way that not being enters into it is as otherness, the fact that fat is other than thin. So there's some not being involved right there in just describing things. So it ends up being a discussion of grammar on the one hand, the difference between adjectives and nouns and be as a verb, and correspondingly the differences between the metaphysical categories that go with those, that correspond to each of those.
Hey, before we go on, let's talk about our sponsor, which is Blue Apron again. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. So I've been doing this. Wes, you've done this before.
Yeah, I was using Blue Apron. I used it for more than a year. I'm going to go back to it. I'm just sort of in transition right now. Really loved it. Really had a big effect on my life. I was eating much healthier. I lost weight. And basically, it's like the completely right amount of effort for someone like me. Someone who wants to cook but is afraid of cooking, doesn't have experience cooking, usually doesn't get good results. For me, because I didn't have to go to the grocery store, I just got the ingredients. They were good ingredients. The recipes were simple and they almost always came out great. It was like a perfect experience. And it was also sort of like because I was doing a 3-time-a-week plan. So it was almost like having a cooking lesson 3 times a week. That's how inexperienced I was. Going through all that, I learned a lot about cooking in general. A big thumbs up from me to Blue Apron.
Right. So they send you fresh, high quality ingredients from their community of artisanal suppliers, family run farms, fisheries and ranchers. They have new recipes every week created by Blue Apron's culinary team. They're not repeated within a year, but each meal comes with the recipe card, you know, step by step and with pre-portioned ingredients. Of course, you could save the recipe cards and use those because I've liked just about everything that we've gotten. And you can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. You just log into the site. You can choose delivery options to fit your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. So, Wes, tell us about the meals available in July.
Spinach and basil pesto gnocchi with summer squash, green beans, and fresh mozzarella. Spiced pork tacos with avocado, pickled onion, and elote. Is it elote? Elote-style corn. Summer vegetable pizza with garlic, lemon, broccolini. The ingredients are so good, I can't pronounce half of them.
Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/PEL. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait.
That's blueapron.com/PEL.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, let's get back to it.
So it's around 253 that he gets to the vowels, consonants, and the letters, and the grammar example. So every one of them who desires to answer truly will adopt the third and remaining hypothesis of the communion of some with some. So I'm hoping this will clarify this. Quite true. This communion of some with some may be illustrated by the case of letters. For some letters do not fit each other, while others do, of course. And the vowels especially are sort of bond which pervades all the other letters, so that without a vowel, one consonant cannot be joined to another. True. But does everyone know what letters will unite with what, or is art required in order to do so? Art is required. What art? The art of grammar. Moving on a little bit. And as classes are admitted by us in the like manner to be some of them capable and others incapable of intermixture, so some things like rest and motion are opposites. Must not he who would rightly show what kinds will unite and what will not proceed by the help of science in the path of argument? And will he not ask if the connecting links are universal? And so capable of intermixture with all things, and again in divisions, whether there are not other universal classes, which make them possible. And so there are these universal classes like otherness and likeness, sameness. And
yeah. So everything is, but everything also partakes of not being in that it is other than something else. Right. Unless you're talking about being itself. Being itself is not other than.
Right. And everything is the same with itself. So not everything is at rest. Not everything is at motion. There are some of these classes which won't apply to everything. But we do have this higher level, what he calls the greater kinds, which apply to everything. And the way this helps solve the paradox of not being is that we can ultimately say that being and not being are not like rest and motion. They're not these contradictory classes. They are more like same and other. Everything can be the same to itself, but other than something else at the same time.
Yeah, and they make that explicit link between non-being and other.
Right. So to not be is not like an existential predicate. It's like there's a non-existential predicate. So that's the paradox. You get the is and the not. But it's a relation. Not being is a relation between beings. So to say Theaetetus is not flying is this negative relation between the particular Theaetetus and then a class or a property.
Or to say that the image that you have, you know, that's connoted, that's represented by the sentence, does not correspond to the thing in reality. It is other than. Even though, of course, it would be other than, even if it did correspond, because a sentence is not the same as the thing. But as he's described earlier, an imitation in this way, a sentence is kind of an imitation of the world, like a picture is an imitation of the world, but a false sentence would be even a worse imitation of the world. It would be an out of proportion, just like the sculpture could retain the proportions of the real thing, or it could be out of proportion.
Well, the false sentence is like, it's not the case that Theaetetus is flying.
Why is that false?
Sorry, Theaetetus is flying. We don't analyze that as saying, hey, this entity that exists doesn't exist. We don't fall into that paradox. We say that someone is asserting a relationship between Theaetetus and flying, and it's that relationship that doesn't exist. We don't have an entity, Theaetetus flying, that doesn't end up existing. We have, well, I'm not sure if that's the right
analysis. Why couldn't you just say it's other than the truth?
Because I don't think otherness is about the relationship between propositions and the world. The otherness is the relationships between properties and objects, or between properties and properties, or classes and classes. The otherness is a metaphysical thing. And the reason why I mention that is, like, there's not a lot about the mind here and the relationship between the mind and the world. If you really wanted to locate nothingness, you could talk about the mind. It is a no thing. And if you're a materialist, then the mind is a great example of a nothing. And that's, of course, the way Sartre and other existentialists will refer to the mind as nothingness, to try and call out what subjectivity is. Now, if you want to locate appearances or images in the cognitive sense, that's where you would locate that too. And you would say, well, yeah, there is a sense in which a representation, a mental representation, is a nothing. But I don't see any of that here.
No. But they do start talking about speech, and they come back to the way in which you would talk about truth and falsehood and being and non-being, and sort of locate the origin of the false and how we should deal with that in speech. This is all around 260. Because speech is an interweaving of forms.
Very confusing, given that he's using the term form, and it's Plato, and it's not form. It's not that word. It's a different Greek word, right?
Is it the same? It's just a, right?
Is that the word for form in capital F?
Yeah, but I think you're right to say that it's probably confusing in that, yeah, it's the eidos, yeah. But sometimes, you know, eidos just means eidos, and sometimes it means eidos.
Sorry, what were you reading again? What was the
line 260, they make this transition into talking about speech.
We might be able to assert discourse to be a kind of being. If we could not, the worst consequences would follow. We should have no philosophy. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, this is.
And Theaetetus says, wait, it's like very true, but I do not understand why at this moment we must determine the nature of discourse. Can't we be done already? God damn it.
You're right. So that's the beginning of this section where they talk about the nature of speech.
Yeah. Is there any quotes you had picked out, Wes? Because to me, it just seemed like more of the same just spelling out the argument that we've already tried to hash through.
Well, with the whole not being is the principle of the other comes like around 256. We didn't really...
Okay, let's read some quotes of that to make sure we got that.
Yeah. Not being necessarily exists in the case of motion and of every class. For the nature of the other entertaining into them all makes each of them other than being, and so non-existent, and therefore of all of them in the like manner we may truly say that they are not, and again, inasmuch as they partake of being, that they are and are existent. Every class, then, has a plurality of being and infinity of not being. And being itself may be said to be other than the other kinds. So, right, being, interestingly enough, is other than motion, other than rest, other than same, other than one. Certainly. Then we may infer that being is not, in respect of as many other things as there are, for not being these, it is itself one, and is not the other things, which are infinite in number, all these other classes. And then the big climax is, when we speak of not being, we speak, I suppose, not of something opposed to being, but only different. How inclusive.
So at least we can see here why Hegel liked this part, that this is very much like the hashing through of the basics of being and not being in Hegel's logic. It's not exactly lifted from here. He's not saying that being and not being taken absolutely would be the same thing, but he is kind of looking at the next step that Hegel had. Being is always being something specific, which means being other than everything else.
Determinateness requires otherness.
Isn't the first step just noting that the not of something is, in general, not the contrary, not the exact opposite of it?
Exactly, because that's the whole rest and motion thing. If you treat all these different classes as incommunicable, as being radically separate or opposites, then you run into trouble. But yeah, so the not beautiful is not the opposite of beauty, but it's the other than beauty.
Yeah, and this in some ways makes sense why we had this whole division stuff at the beginning, right? Is that's exactly how this method of division is working, is you're separating things into this and not this. And they're not opposites at all. You've divided them. And then, just as you were saying, you are also instantiating by dividing off the not this away, you instantiate the this.
Give it determinacy.
Give it determinacy. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all I meant by instantiate. In some ways, you're declaring it by the very act of cordoning off all the not being. And so that act of distinguishing is as much about saying what it's not. In fact, I don't know Hegel well enough to say, is the activity of cordoning off the being of something about sort of looking at the inside and finding out where the border of that being is, or is it more about cordoning off all the things that aren't that being? Those would be two pretty different things. The first requires that you know what it is. The second just requires that you know what it's not.
Yeah, I think it depends on sort of what stage in the Hegelian laying out of the ontology is.
Okay.
But, you know, it is relevant here because he's reflecting on the same dialogue, basically, that we are in thinking about, you know, what are we supposed to take away from this? Are we supposed to, as I described it, just say, oh, yeah, he's just prefiguring Aristotle and talk about properties versus substances and make it all very simple like that? Or is he retaining more of the subtlety that I was saying he was ignoring about the, especially Heraclitus's take on Parmenides' view? Folks should go back and listen to our Heraclitus episode, because that ended up just being a very, I think Dylan captured it pretty well in talking about the ratio is the thing that stays steady among all the tension, but still, it's kind of a mind-bending view.
Well, there is something that sounds pretty Heraclitian actually here. You know, he talks about the beautiful and the not beautiful and the just and the not just, and the whole point of that is that those are equally entities. It's not like one is a non-entity and the other is an entity. That's what otherness gives us. And then he says, so this is around 258, then, as would appear, the opposition of a part of the other and a part of being to one another is, if I may venture to say so, as truly essence as being itself. Oh, I thought he was saying it was the essence of being. Okay. And implies not the opposite of being, but only what is other than being. Okay. So that's more on the line of determination, right? To give the essence.
This is kind of where it started to get very redundant to me, and I stopped taking such good notes.
Then it's not being as a kind of being. Does that get us back to where Dylan was?
Because the very next step after this is moving on to the nature of speech and relationship between speech and opinion. And then we get some more language stuff about nouns and verbs and then how speech is a weaving.
Just to read a little bit more. So 259, let not anyone say then that while affirming the opposition of not being to being, we still assert the being of not being. For as to whether there is an opposite of being, no, to that inquiry we have long said goodbye. It may or may not be and may not be capable of definition. All right. Well, that's not helpful.
No, it's the big question, is there an opposite of being? It's a bad question. That's his conclusion. We've moved on. We're at the next stage of the dialectic here. Once you introduce otherness, you don't have to ask the question in that way anymore.
We are saying there is a communion of classes and that being and difference or other traverse all things and mutually interpenetrate so that the other partakes of being and by reason of this participation is and yet is not that of which it partakes, but other and being other than being. It is clearly a necessity that not being should be. And again, being through partaking of the other becomes a class other than the remaining classes, and being other than all of them is not each one of them and is not all the rest, so that undoubtedly there are thousands upon thousands of cases in which being is not, and all other things, whether regarded individually or collectively, in many respects are, and in many respects are not. I don't know. I just really like that speech.
It's just as good as the one in the apology. It's so persuasive. Do you want to sum it up so it doesn't just sound like a tongue twister?
Yeah, it's the idea that we have being and otherness, and otherness is not the opposite of being. It's not in the same way that motion and rest were opposites, but being actually can partake of other, right? In the way that motion couldn't partake of rest, being is other to the class otherness, and it's to other classes as well, like sameness. And otherness partakes of being, so there is no paradox in that. So that's the sense in which not being is, right? Things are other to each other.
All right. So being is not simply the property that everything has. As with Hegel, it has this multivalent appearance. It is other to the class of otherness, but yet it is something that each of the other things have. You know, so it is communicable in the language of this, both to individuals in that they have the property of being and is communicable via otherness, you know, with concepts. The concept of being is other than the concept of other. So that's interesting. There's not too many things that are applicable to both concepts.
Yeah. In fact, being partakes of other in order to be other to other. And otherness has to partake
of being. There you go.
So it's this idea of some things being communicable and others not.
That sounds like a new way of describing some kind of new drug. I'm going to partake of other in order to become other to other. Well, yeah. I think that should be a sex position. That should be, let's...
That would be a good drug, just other, or perfume, the other.
Friends of mine in college were in a band called The Others.
Nice. Was that self-consciously from the sophist?
No, I'm sure it was not.
So we want to move back to where Dylan was.
Okay, oh, language.
Yeah, we might be able to wrap up with this, right?
Yes. That. So just to again, mirroring the Phaedrus, which talked about love for the first half and then moved to talking about rhetoric. And then at the very end had a pretty damn important thing about language, about writing versus speaking. That was very short. Well, here we kind of have the same thing in that we start talking about categorization and how we figure out the definition of something and specifically the sophist. And then we move to this talk about does not being actually exist. And then we have a bit about language, but unlike last time, it's less of an afterthought. It's more like the culmination of everything before, that we're going to say what the sophist is. The sophist is somebody who can tell you false things. That's why we started talking about not being in the first place. And so, of course, we have to apply our talk about not being to talking about false sentences. So you have a quote for us?
Yeah. He's talking right around 260C. This whole section, he's just introducing what we're going to come up with an understanding of what speech is.
Yeah, we want to get back to the possibility of false opinion and false speech will set us up for that. Yeah.
And he refers back to the earlier discussion saying, certainly non-being came to light for us as some one kind that is and is among the others dispersed through all the things that are. Just show. Then the next thing we must look into is whether it mixes with both opinion and speech. Why is that? If it doesn't mix with these, then it's necessary that all things are true. But if it does mix, then both false opinion and speech come about. For to opine or to speak things that are not, this, I suppose, is the false, insofar as it comes about in both thought and speech. So the origin of how we have false things is this kind of mixing, because everything we say isn't true and everything we say isn't false.
So I will say that your translation is more felicitous than the Jowett here. There is falsehood which thus arises in the region of thought and in speech.
Stanley Rosen called it one of the best translations of a Platonic dialogue I have seen in any language. That's on the back jacket.
Whoa.
So we have this idea there can be this relation of otherness out there in the world. Falsity becomes relational, right? It becomes this thing between words, words which don't belong next to each other, like Theaetetus flies. So in the way, same way in the at the metaphysical level, Theaetetus is other to flying. On the level of language, Theaetetus and flies don't belong next to each other. So when you say it's not the case that Theaetetus flies, you're not asserting that there's the entity Theaetetus flies, because if you're referring to it, it's an entity, does not exist, creating the paradox. You're saying that the entity Theaetetus doesn't belong next to, is other than the entity flies. So you get no paradox of non-being there.
So it has to be not just other than, right? Because even if the bird is flying, still the concept bird is other than the concept flying.
That's an interesting wrinkle. But I think other than in this case is going to be a way of saying doesn't participate in, or you can't predicate of. So even though the Theaetetus, the particular, is other than the concept flies and other than every other concept in some higher level sense, I think what's being said here, other than is being used as a synonym for falsity, and or if it's other than in the world, then it can't be predicated in language. Otherwise, we haven't solved our problem.
So this just makes you really appreciate the development of concepts like predication that you did not have. Just start using communicates with instead of all these things. Is communicable. See how that works for you.
He's bequeathing, he's inventing the concept of predication in these dialogues.
Pretty cool.
So that sets us up for the conclusion. Because thought is silent speech, and opinion is the silent assent to that or the denial of it. And then imagination is an expression of these things. So if speech can admit true and false, then so can thought and imagination. And so we can have things like false opinion, and we can have these phantasms or appearances that are in some non-paradoxical sense false or deceptive or dissembling.
Still at the end of 260, they've established that there's falsehood, which arises in the region of thought and speech. And where there is falsehood, surely there must be deceit. Theaetetus says, yes. And if there's deceit, then all things must be full of idols and images and fancies. To be sure. Into that region, the sophist, as we said, made his escape. And when he had got there, denied the very possibility of falsehood. No one, he argued, either conceived or uttered falsehood inasmuch as not being denied in any way partake of being. True. And now, not being has been shown to partake of being. And therefore, he will not continue fighting in this direction, but he will probably say that some ideas partake of not being and some not. That language and opinion are of the non-partaking class, and he will fight to the death against the existence of the image-making in the fantastic art in which you have placed him. Because, as he will say, opinion and language do not partake of not being. When he originally was talking about being ignorant, it's just being malformed. You're aiming at something, but you're not hitting. And so it seemed like a lie also was something there was malformed about it. But now he's saying that there's just because there's falsehood. So if you're ignorant, you believe something false. And that necessarily involves deceit. Should I be troubled by that? Or is this a translation issue?
The interesting question is whether it's proper to call the sophist deceitful. If he knows that he doesn't know, and then he's just deceiving, it's a much different position than thinking that he does know.
Can we just cut through the bullshit and call the sophist Trump? Is Trump actually deceitful, or is he just doesn't know that he's just saying inconsistent things and et cetera? There's the question.
It depends on the kind of sophist,
Trump is,
right?
Trump is not using heuristic. Trump is not using disputation. He's appealing completely to emotion. If he's a rhetorician, he's cut out any of the techniques that involve reason. Or
yeah. But I thought I heard him in a speech to the White Decency Union something about how can you say that there's falsity? There's no, everything is one and there is no falsity. Something like that.
Did he really say that? Or are you just having fun?
The fact that you don't actually know.
Well, I know there's no, yeah, I know there wasn't a white decency idiot, but yeah, for him to say something like that, yeah, that would not be beyond him. To relate Trump to this office, I think doesn't work.
All right.
You can dislike him in other categories. Some unlikable categories commune with Trump and some don't.
He doesn't even use the concept of predication in his speeches. He just uses communion. All right. So how do we know that this is the best of all the definitions that we're given of the sophist? He's the deceiver. He's the one who teaches you false things. So it's not the fact that he makes money off. It's not that he's a hunter that's the main thing. It's not that he asks questions that purges you from beliefs. He's not a divider in that way. That it's the art of mimicry. He's a dissembler or ironical imitator.
So we come back now after this digression. We're going to come back to that definition in terms of production of images. Because what we've done is we've proved that the sophist can't escape into relativism, can't escape into the idea that there can be no such thing as falsehood. That's around 264, I guess.
We could read the last two lines. I'll read The Stranger and you read Theaetetus.
He then, who traces the pedigree of his art as follows, who belonging to the conscious or dissembling section of the art of causing self-contradiction, is an imitator of appearance and is separated from the class of fantastic, which is a branch of image-making, into that further division of creation, the juggling of words, a creation human and not divine. Anyone who affirms the real sophist to be of this blood and lineage will say the very truth.
Undoubtedly, motherfucker. And then it ends.
I mean, there is lots of interesting stuff in how he gets there, but we're probably not going to have time for that.
You didn't spend any time with this dialogue in your life, Wes, did you?
Not as much as you, actually. And like, even though I said I wrote my senior...
That's not true.
No.
Can you just tell us...
You speak a falsehood.
Tell us as part of the epilogue here. So you told us that is your senior thesis, is that right?
Well, it was on the symposium, and I took a tiny... Like, I didn't really... When I was writing about things, I wasn't really writing about those things. I was writing about what was in my own head and using these things as launching pads. So it was really surprising to me to reread this and to realize the extent to which my senior thesis had nothing to do with the sophist, although it did have a lot to do with the symposium. I mean, what I was interested in was the talk about language and interweaving, but I was really fusing that together with the idea of the erotic and reproduction, a sense in which the mind is reproducing images, and the analogy of Aristophanes' lovers who are separated. They're called symbolon. They're compared to the way messages were validated, like two parts of a coin, you stick them together, and that those were called symbolon. So the idea of two things coming together, that erotic analogy being the essence of what it meant to signify, to be a symbol. So this whole idea of language in the sophist, of signification and predication are related, where the interweaving is on the analogy to the lovers. And anyway, I know it's a mess, but that's it. Like, I didn't really think about any of this, any of the paradoxes of non-being, or any of the...
Are there any philosophers after this that really ran with language as interweaving and like made more of that analogy that we know about? I can sort of impose that on like the Hegel's dialectic, but I don't know what Hegel specifically said about language and whether he made... I kind of doubt that particular word pops up a lot, but I don't know.
Think of Wittgenstein's Tractatus and the links in the chain, the attempt to model reality on facts, right? Where instead of objects, reality is fundamentally relational, things like that.
Right. Because I was thinking of Wittgenstein and Tractatus as we were going through this, just in terms of language being a model of reality, and does it match reality? Is it distorted in some way? And that's not the way Wittgenstein talks. But yeah, once you get in this interweaving thing, certainly Plato is not running with that analogy to talk about how interweaving sets of sentences can equally well represent a larger state of affairs as completely different sets of sentences that sort of represent a different theory, which is just ultimately they could boil down to the same observable facts, but you could have a different conceptual scheme. There's nothing like that in here, but still you get the interleaving.
You get a lot of problems if your ontology is objects. It's all thing based, right? And you just have things and then properties, and then you have to invent, because you need to ground somehow the truth of the stuff, you need properties to be these real things. You get Platonic ideas and stuff like that. So you get all kinds of problems. So if you say the atoms for Wittgenstein, if you say those are already fused, subject predicate fusions, and those are the unanalyzable basics, you avoid all that. So the weaving is built in. So I think that's definitely related to this.
And I think Hugo Weaving played Wittgenstein in the... No, I don't know.
What?
The actor, Mr. Anderson. Anyway, real people out there know who Hugo Weaving is. Maybe you don't.
Really?
He was Elrond in Lord of the Rings, too.
Can't tell if you're just making all this up.
It's true.
They made movies of the Lord of the Rings?
Yes, but they were distorted in image as compared to the book.
Yes, they were.
Next time, speaking of distorted in image, we're going to read Martha Nussbaum. It's not a segue. We're going to read Martha Nussbaum's Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice. All those concepts are woven together in her book, and we're going to be talking to her. So we're not just going to be making stuff up. We're going to be getting the real deal, getting some up-close weaving. So come back for that. You could also, in the meantime, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Maybe go to our Facebook group. You could become a Partially Examined Life citizen and start a group on The Statesman, because we're not going to do that anytime soon, but it happens just the day after Sophist. Aren't you in a lot of anticipation after a bunch of hours of listening to this for more of the method of division? So you should, definitely start a not school group related to something like this. Remember the great discourses doing the stuff on the Plato and you've heard about? And anyway, there's lots of stuff going on. Please get involved. We would love to have you down here. All right. Thanks, guys. Good night, everybody.
Night.
Good night.
Well, today I am dumb, and it doesn't feel good. 'Cause today I feel dumb, about as dumb as I could. I feel a fog across my eyes and act a bit lobotomized. Today I am dumb, yeah. And today I am sick, just a little bit sick. 'Cause today I feel sick, and I hope it won't stick. I'm gonna moan incessantly and get my focus off of me. 'Cause today I feel sick. Today I feel small. Do you think that I should? I scare the fog that fills my eyes, reflecting back I'm undersized. Oh, today I feel small, yeah. Let me go and sleep it off. Don't wanna hold my head aloft. I think that I'm still slowing down. I'm not sure that I'm still around. 'Cause today I feel dumb, and it's done me some good. Well, today I feel dumb, not as dumb as I could. To think too much will make you tense, so I've been trying.